When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Dr. Kara Kennedy. Kara is an educator, researcher, and writer in the areas of science fiction, technology, and digital and AI literacy. She wrote her PhD dissertation on the representation of the women of the Bene Gesserit in Frank Herbert's Dune series, which was published in 2021 as a monograph titled Women's Agency in the Dune Universe, Tracing Women's Liberation Through Science Fiction. She was previously on the podcast to talk about the representation of the Fremen in the Dune universe, and is back again today to talk more about the Fremen and representations of indigenous and nomadic peoples in Dune, in light of the recent release of the Dune Part 2 movie, as well as the publication of Kara's latest book, which is titled Adaptations of Dune, Frank Herbert's Story on Screen. So thank you so much for joining me again.
Hi, thanks to be here.
So last time you were on the podcast, we talked about the Fremen in Dune, who are the indigenous inhabitants of the planet Arrakis, or Dune. And the planet is the sole source of the valuable drug, spice, as a result of which the planet is colonized and spice extracted by the Imperium. And the Fremen are fighting to free themselves and their planet from colonization, which they do under the leadership of Paul Atreides, who they take as their messiah, as has been foretold in religious prophecies. Just very broadly simplifying the kind of plot of at least of the most recent movie. And in our previous conversations, we talked a lot about the real world parallels and influences in Dune. The planet Arrakis is sort of based on the Middle East. Spice represents oil. There are inspirations from Islam. There are parallels to the Great Arab Revolt during World War I with Paul Atreides, kind of modeled on Lawrence of Arabia. And of course, the Fremen, as we talked about, are based on the nomadic Bedouin in the Middle East. And in part two of the Dune movie, which was just released in theaters, we spend a lot more time with the Fremen, almost the entire movie, really. So I wanted to talk more about the Fremen and their depiction, both on screen and in print. And my first question is about the nature of nomadism among the Fremen. So the official marketing for the movie puts nomadism front and center. This is just reading from the first sentence of the plot synopsis for the movie's IMDb page, says, a boy becomes the messiah of nomads on a desert planet that has giant worms that protect a commodity called spice. So in light of that, I was a bit disappointed, selfishly, that the movie, at least, doesn't really delve too much into the Fremen as nomads specifically. Their nomadism is more implicit, and that we do see them traveling around, living in tents, things like that. So I'm wondering how the book deals with that. Is nomadism a more explicit characteristic of the Fremen? Is their mobility kind of a more important quality of their characterization or of their kind of function in the novels?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that it is heavily emphasized in the book, because pretty much as soon as Jessica and Paul stumble upon the Fremen, they go to Stogar Siege, Siege Tabor, and that's really where most of the remaining action seems to take place, because that's where the Water of Life ceremony happens, and the point is that Jessica has an opportunity to further become integrated into the tribe, because they're Reverend Mother of that siege happens to be essentially dying, and so they need someone to take her place, and she's not going to be able to be well enough to travel anymore. So they sort of allude to Romalo isn't going to be able to travel anymore because we're a people who travel, and so we're going to need to have a replacement who's more able. But in terms of them moving around a lot. It's more alluded to that they're going on raids, you know, and they're using sandworms to get around and to attack the Harkonnen. But I think Siege life is a bigger part of what Herbert shows us, like the interactions between different Fremen and their customs and some of how they interact with one another inside of a like a sheltered location, rather than showing them on the move, probably just for narrative space reasons.
And what are the sieges exactly? Because so we do spend quite a bit of time in them, or in one, I guess, in the movie. And so I'm wondering how those are described. You know, we just talked a little bit about this before we turned on the recording, how space and architecture are described in the books. And so I'm wondering how the sieges are depicted. And like you said, what are the things that happen in them versus what are the things that the Fremen sort of do outside of the sieges in other spaces or other parts of the planet?
So the sieges are, you could think of them like a kind of a like cave, like a place of safety away from the elements of Dune, like the sandworms and the heat and the Harkonnen or whoever the enemies happen to be. And there's a bit of mystery, I think, about them, because part of the issue is that the Harkonnen, who have been on the planet extracting spice for quite some time, don't have an accurate idea of how many Fremen there are. Mm-hmm. And one of their major miscalculations is that they think there's not really that many of them to worry about. But actually, when the Atreides come to the planet and Duncan Idaho goes to sort of be an ambassador to them, he comes back and reports back to Leto, there's actually like millions of them. Mm-hmm. And they're tucked away in these communities, essentially, that can go unnoticed. And if we think about in the real world, right, that happens. I mean, in the recent conflicts between countries, that's been one of the features, is that it's really hard to locate and to count who your enemy is when they're so hidden and they're able to move around in sort of like hidden places. What happens in the sieges? Yeah, different things happen in the siege, but that's really where I think the heart of their community is the siege. They have to go out for various reasons, but then they come back and that's like their hearth. And so it's a place that has a lot of significance to them. And so when Jessica remembers seeing Siege Tabor on a map and she says, "Oh, I bet we're going to Siege Tabor," Stogar and all the Fremen are taken aback that she would know, because that was supposed to be a secret place. And so that's one of the ways that, as a Bene Gesserit, she picks up on this little detail, and then she's able to leverage that to make her seem like she's, you know, has access to the secret Fremen knowledge that you're not supposed to have as an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sort of seeming kind of evasiveness that nomadic peoples pose to central governments or to colonial governments is, of course, sort of one of the main problems that nomadic peoples pose in the eyes of the state. This, the fact that they seem to kind of know the local landscape better, are able to hide, are able to, you know, move around, are simply kind of difficult to locate, and therefore are difficult to integrate into a state, and difficult to kind of perform the sort of role of the state towards, that they're difficult to tax, they're difficult to count, they're difficult to locate for censuses, they're difficult to recruit into the military. That's, of course, one of the major reasons in our world that states seek to make nomadic peoples non-nomadic, right? Those themes and those issues do come up quite a bit, at least in the movie, the fact of, and that could be read, you know, as sort of a problem of sort of warfare in this context. But it did seem to me that the kind of the reason the Fremen are so troublesome to the Harkonnen are those characteristics of nomadic peoples, that they know the planet so well, they know it, you know, infinitely better than the Harkonnens do, and are able to use it better to their advantage, that they're able to kind of hide and go completely undetected and unlocated. And so that brings me to something else that I wanted to talk about, which is that in this new movie, something we learn about the Fremen that I think was not present in the first one at all is that there's a seemingly a division among the Fremen between northern and southern populations. The Fremen characters that we spend the most time with are living in the north of Arrakis, and these are seemingly both a smaller population group, but also a more advanced one, perhaps. At the very least, they're characterized as less religious than the Southern Fremen, who are described as the sort of quote-unquote Southern fundamentalist tribes, and as the ones who are much more accepting of the messianic prophecies and ready to accept Paul Atreides as this messiah. So what does this look like in the books? How are the northern versus southern Fremen depicted?
Yeah, that's not from the books. So that's why it's such a surprising move.
Okay.
I would say we should be careful about using like the term advanced to describe people as not religious, because I think that's a tension in the film that I find it's problematic, is that if you believe in something, that means that you should be sort of even made fun of. Mm-hmm. I think that Stilgar, when Shani notes that Stilgar is supposedly from the South, well, first of all, it's not explained why then he's not in the South,
right.
But also that he seems to be less thinking
right.
than she is, and that skepticism is somehow a positive quality.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the how they treated religion in terms of that. And I thought it was interesting that they used the word fundamentalist so many times, and they seem to be trying to distance themselves from Middle Eastern religions.
Yeah, like,
and yet at the same time use this very loaded word.
Very carefully avoiding saying jihad, which is certainly used in the books, but not in the movies. Yeah, I mean, I guess it just seemed to me in the movies that they were setting up kind of how I saw it. So it's interesting to hear that maybe this isn't in the books at all, was that the Northern Fremen were kind of the fighters, and therefore had more kind of advanced like technology. And I sort of read it as they were the ones who were sort of actively fighting the Harkonnens, and they were the ones who had the most weaponry, at least, and who had maybe best figured out how to use like the sandworms and other sort of tools of the desert to fight the Harkonnen, whereas the Southern Fremen seemed to be more isolated from everything else that was going on the planet, and more kind of ensconced in their sheltered, isolated part of the planet, and that was what had allowed the Bene Gesserit missionary activities to take hold amongst them. That was sort of what I thought was kind of being alluded to, or sort of the division among the Fremen society as a whole that was being set up. And then there's also this, when all the characters are all of the Fremen and Paul and Jessica are in the South, there's a moment where Chani is trying to speak at this leadership meeting, and somebody sort of tells her to like stop talking, as this, you know, calls her like Northern woman or something. So it implies that there is this sort of division among the society that kind of goes both ways, right? That the Northerners see the Southerners as more backwards, like you said, like Chani and some of her other cohort really look down on these prophecies, whereas the Southerners sort of look down on the Northern ones as being sort of like infidels almost, or just sort of completely unbelieving. So in light of that, then, how is Fremen society as a whole depicted in the books? You know, in that phrase, Southern fundamentalist tribes, the other word that stood out to me as interesting was the word tribes. And that's a specific unit of political organization. So are the Fremen as a whole a kind of tribally segmented society? Is that a feature of their society in the books?
Yes, that is a feature. So Stilgar is the leader of his tribe, which is the one that we know through Jessica and Paul being among them, and that's the one that they integrate into. But there are other tribes that have other leaders. And so when Paul is nearing the point where he's getting strong enough to make a move toward the end of the novel, people start pressuring him to call Stilgar out in terms of there can only be one, presumably one male leader for each siege or each tribe. And so because this is, you know, this is their way essentially, that you need to take out Stilgar and then you can become the new leader. And Paul makes a little plan in the back channels with Stilgar and Jessica to make it seem like that might be what he does, but then actually he decides that's a completely ridiculous ritual. He said, you know, which they did have that a little bit in the film. Why would I, you know, why would I deprive the Fremen of the skilled fighter just to, you know, maintain your ritual? And he rejects that premise. And essentially in the book, he says, or he takes the role that Liet Kynes had. So Liet Kynes was the only one that they thought could speak for all Fremen, which was a significant role because he was also a scientist and part of the Imperium. And yet through the terraforming project, he was able to unite all Fremen and speak for all Fremen, you know, overcoming that like tribal, you know, kind of the tribal disagreements. But what the film does, which is a substantial deviation from the book, is deny a sense of a unified Fremen culture and religion. And to me, that is a really significant change that alters completely the message from the book, which is that Paul comes to this unified culture and he's able to take advantage of these religious myths, which were spread throughout the whole Fremen society, because Jessica even comments that Reverend Mother Romalo even has the same name that the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mothers do. That's how firmly the myths took hold. And so they see an example right there in Siege Tabor of the myths having taken hold. And so this idea that there's Fremen that don't believe or that live somewhere else, and that's just not at all in the book. They're very much a society of believers. And in terms of like, they do have a south in the book, but that's where Chani goes with their child. And it's a place of more security because it is farther away from the Harkonnen enemies. But that's where Chani talks about they do the kind of scientific work and the factory work and help with making things for Fremen society. So it's not a place of just kind of going and hanging out in an isolated place. It's a place of work.
And so what do you think the function is of creating this kind of division within Fremen society? What do you think that does for the storytelling in the films?
I think it's a very postmodern idea creeping through and a very Western idea to me, a cynical view of religion,
right,
and almost a fear of what religion can do, because I think the idea that there are believers and non-believers in a society undermines the sense of the unified culture, which we already had in the first film, which is no unified accent, no unified ethnicity, a move away from Arabic. So that just further continues the sense that these aren't kind of one people. And I think it's trying to problematize religion, but what it ends up doing is really just goes for that individual idea that faith is something that is manipulative, or it makes you weak if you can't, you know, think for yourself. If you have a faith, then somehow you are less than. And I think that's to me a signal of the West's lack of comfort with people of faith, right, as the West gets more secular, and possibly a divide between West and East, and cultures that are, you know, still quite religious. And so in the book, having that shared faith, even though, yes, we as the reader know that it was partially planted by the Bene Gesserit, you know, as a merger of their own religion with the Bene Gesserit myths, but that faith is what enables them to band together under one leader, and it enables them to overcome their enemies in the end. And the Bene Gesserit also have a faith, it's not a religious faith, but it's a faith that they can control bloodlines mm-hmm. and politically maneuver to be able to create this powerful being that they want to control. And so I think the film to me is trying to undermine that with this kind of postmodern skepticism mm-hmm. that doesn't want to mm-hmm. engage with the power that religion has. And it wants to try to talk about religion as an oppressive force and even, you know, making fun of Stogar and the other believers for believing in something. Right. But when I look at the context, right, you talked about the Lawrence of Arabia context, both sides in that conflict were Muslim. It was not a war over faith. It was a war over, you know, land and power. And so the problem to me wasn't so much that Lawrence helps the Arabs. It was that the British government reneged on their promise of what it, you know, promised them. And so in the book, Paul helps the Fremen and he does help them get what he promised. He does help with the terraforming project. It just kind of ends up backfiring in later books. But that to me is what the trying to have people that don't believe, hard for me to see how do you reconcile that with having a unified culture, because it's felt more like a Western culture of people scoffing at religion.
And so where do you think that can go in future installments of the movie, if they've already set up this idea that the Fremen are not a unified culture, which is counter to the books? How do you think that's going to bear out, or could bear out, given the plot of the next installments of the books? Do you think that this theme will be sort of continued and enhanced, or can it not be in light of what does end up happening in the future books?
Honestly, I don't know. Like they're moving so far away from the book that it's possible they are just going to untether themselves from any of the messaging that they don't want to deal with. But the ending, having Chani as a doubting figure, I don't know where you go coming back from that, because she's such an important part of Dune Messiah and she's such a motivating force for Paul as he starts realizing the problems with what he's done. Mm-hmm. And so having her pitted against him and really having Jessica pitted against him as well, I think they're trying to have more sense that what Paul is doing is wrong. But they've already made Paul a reluctant hero as well, which is another change from the book. So he didn't even really want to seize power. And then Chani's really upset that he's seizing power. So what is there left to critique? Because right. even if the Fremen are unleashed on the universe, they change the ending and give them a plausible reason to go to war, when in the book there really is no reason that probably we would see as justifiable. They just sort of want revenge for right. what's happened to them, and they want to kind of cleanse the universe. But it's easier to just say that it's a war against some other nation states than a jihad.
Right. In speaking of religion, this is something very small that jumped out at me in the movie. There's a scene where the character Stilgar, who's, like we talked about, a military and political leader of the Fremen, is teaching Paul how to live in the desert. And he lists a bunch of things to be aware of that Paul needs to know. And at the end of that list, he says to be careful of the jinn, who are these spirits or creatures that live in the desert that can possess you or trick you into seeing things that aren't there. I don't remember exactly what he says, but it was something along those lines. And that stood out to me because it's so clearly just is Islamic religious and cultural beliefs. The jinn is these spirits, otherworldly creatures that are believed to often to live in the desert and to play tricks on or to deceive humans. So it stood out to me as this very kind of instantly recognizable real world element plopped into an otherwise alternate universe. And so I wanted to ask about that, and A, if that's something from the books at all. Do Jin appear in Herbert's books, at least in any kind of noteworthy way? And B, are there other instances like that in the books where entities appear with the exact same names and definitions as we use them without any changes to make them kind of more sci-fi, more belonging to another world or another timeline?
I'm looking at my copy of the book. The only use of Jin, it does appear in the book, and it's when Paul and Jessica have stumbled upon the Fremen and they're hearing voices coming out of the, you know, the rocks. And someone says, what have we here, Jin or human?
Mm.
So I guess it's a little bit of a clue for people in the know mm-hmm. that they're potentially looking at, you know, who are these figures? Are they, you know, bad? Or, but even if they're human, you know, they still are outsiders. So that's, I guess, a little bit of cultural reference, just a minor one. In the film, I feel like that scene is really played for laughs. Yeah. I wasn't quite sure whether he was joking or whether he wasn't joking right. or whether it was just the other people that were making fun of him. Like that was one of the examples where I wasn't sure how to read Stilgar mm-hmm. because they took him away from being a solemn figure as he often is in the book, quite serious and undercut his belief system. Mm-hmm. So that to me was hard to see him made fun of when he's such a such a strong character and really our main representation of a Fremen fighter aside from Chani in the book mm-hmm. and of course Jaemys, but Jaemys isn't around for very long. Other examples like Shai Hulud and other Arabic terms mm-hmm. like alluding to like the devil and other religious kind of things in the Bible or other religious texts, I think are in there, but they're not used in a comedic way at all. Right. They're definitely part of the cultural fabric of the Fremen or of other groups. And so, again, I see that as this discomfort with religion and discomfort with mysticism coming through the film. Like they're not sure how to treat it. So they put a little bit in, but then kind of immediately parody it or make it less serious mm-hmm. as a way of kind of dealing with that discomfort.
One thing that I wanted to talk about, or that I guess was troubling to me, although I think this is more just sort of, this is for me not just not having read the books, but at least
shame
I've,
you will one
you know,
day though, right?
When I finish my dissertation, then maybe then maybe I'll get there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. First on your list.
So there are these moments in the movie where we get glimpses of the Fremen as having a different vision for the future ecosystem of the planet. Paul tells Chani about where he comes from, which is this abundant rainfall, and she sort of wonderingly like can't even imagine this. One of the Fremen, I don't remember which one, talks about part of the messianic prophecies around Paul being a future transformation of Arrakis from a desert landscape into a lush green garden-like one. And this was interesting to me because it suggests that despite being presented as the indigenous people of the planet, the Fremen want to significantly and fundamentally change the ecosystem and the topography of their planet, which is very much at odds with how we usually understand indigenous stewardship of their land, right? Of wanting to live in harmony with their natural environment and preserve and protect it, but certainly not radically change it or engage in the kind of terraforming projects that such changes would entail. So to me, this seems very much born out of a kind of dominant worldview that sees deserts and desert landscapes as inherently hostile, inhospitable spaces that are incompatible with life and that need to and should be changed in order to become less desert-like, basically, in order to be cooler or have more water or support more animal life. So does my reading of that align with how the desert as a landscape and as an ecosystem is portrayed in the books? Is there a kind of, what I'm interpreting as a kind of vilification of deserts and a preference for other types of climates?
So this is one of the complexities and the tensions that Herbert builds on in the novel, which is interesting because it's well known as an ecological and environmental novel, even though, as you point out, the Fremen want to terraform and bring a completely different landscape that's lush and green into it. And so, and part of why I think that's a little tricky to understand, especially in the second film, is because most of the limited scientific part of the book was in the first part. And Liat Kynes didn't come across to me so much as a scientist figure, more as a local. And of course, Liat Kynes is not in the second part. So essentially, in Herbert's vision or in his story, it's Westerners like Liat Kynes' father comes to the planet and realizes that it could be transformed if they could get enough water systems going and enough plantings going. They could make it easier to live there, and so he ends up passing that vision down to his son Liat Kynes, who's part Fremen, and so the Fremen see this as an opportunity to have an easier life. And so it is a tension because they already know how to live in the desert, right? They've adapted so well. Like they even, like their blood clots faster. They know how to ride the sandworms. They know how to evade the sandworms. They have come to live in harmony with their environment. And yet the scientist comes in and says, hey, we could make it easier for you. And they look around and say, actually, that sounds really nice. And so what Herbert is trying to show us is even this people that don't really need outside, you know, don't at all need outside interventions to survive, see a promise of an easier life and they go for it. And it's not realized in the first novel, but in later novels point, and you can see some of this tension pointed to if you read the appendix, where you find out that water is poisonous to sandworms. So then you start thinking, well, wait a minute, how are you going to have rain and lush greenery, but still have sandworms, which we know is part of the spice, you know, somehow part of the spice life cycle. So can you really have both of those things at the same time? And the scientists think that they can just wall off a little part of the desert so they can, you know, keep a few sandworms and keep the spice going. But the ecological message is that you can't just start terraforming without radically, you know, altering the whole ecosystem, even if you wanted to keep some of your old ecosystem. And so I guess the sort of tragedy of the book is that the Fremen have been lured into the promise of an easier life, follow a messiah who promises to keep going with that project, and then have pretty much set up their culture to kind of wither away because there's not going to be a need to be sandworm riders and all of the things that have made their culture, you know, what it is. And that's something Herbert deals with in later books. But yeah, you're right to notice the tension there, because some people read the Fremen as, oh, they're this amazing indigenous culture that lives in harmony. Yes, but that doesn't mean that they're not seduced by the attractiveness of science making things easier for them, and you know, so they don't have to suffer anymore.
Along those lines, you know, we talked about this as well before we started the recording, but I was just wondering while watching the movie, you know, you talk and then you mentioned how these are a feature of the books, things like Fremen technology, Fremen science, and then, you know, coming from studying nomadic peoples, big question for me is food sources and sources of other raw materials that the Fremen would need to live. So that was a big thing that I was wondering about for Fremen culture and for their life on this planet, is just where do they get food from? You know, nomadic peoples are kind of defined by their food gathering mechanisms. You know, are they hunter-gatherers? Are they pastoralists? And there are some references, at least in the movie, you know, we see some wildlife, I guess, in the desert, these mice and things like that, but certainly nothing, you know, that would sustain a population to live off of. It seems like, you know, if there's no rain, there can't really be agriculture, anything like that, unless the Fremen have engineered a way around that, like they've done with other kind of water gathering and storage mechanisms. So what does that look like in the books? What are some of the other ways, in addition to the obvious, like, you know, the sandworms, what are some of the other ways that the Fremen have kind of managed to, either sort of, you know, through science, through engineering, through indigenous knowledge, what are the ways in which they've managed to figure out how to live in this environment?
So Herbert's not as interested in going to all those kinds of details. I think part of his world building strategy is to give you a little bit here and there and then leave you to fill in the gaps yourself. So he doesn't talk really too much about what they're eating. It's really more about what they're drinking, I think, in terms of the moisture conservation. But we do know that they have spice in what they eat, because that's part of the issue when Paul goes to live among them, as he notices when he's eating, there's spice in it. And that's really what starts unlocking his visions, is taking in more spice. I'm looking at the book for mentions of food. The Duke does mention yeast culture and hydroponics. So it's possible there's kind of alternative ways of getting food, because it doesn't sound like they have any kind of agriculture to speak of, and it wouldn't make sense for the Fremen to have that kind of thing going on in these caves, because they're constantly being attacked by the Harkonnen. So I think that's one of those, my possibly gap in terms of like how the are on the planet maybe doesn't align with what would actually be realistic. Something to consider is that maybe that's a missing part of the story. I mean, you often don't see in visual depictions, you know, people doing normal things like eating and drinking and going to the bathroom. So that's...
No, but I was just thinking, you know, I've been like rereading and rewatching The Lord of the Rings, and they do kind of, there's that like elvish
Lambda
thread. You know, where that's like very, you know, it's like a little detail, but it's very obviously included to just kind of cover the bases, you know, and to just sort of explain to the audience, like, this is how they're dealing with the food problem on this like long journey. You know, it's just to kind of like check that box so the audience knows, you know, okay, this is how they're eating, you know, and this is why we don't see them like worrying about food or anything, you know, while they're going on this months long hike.
And it's so devastating when Gollum like destroys the last of the Lambdas and blames Sam for it. I just rewatched them last month too.
And so maybe a final question, in light of just rereading The Lord of the Rings and kind of thinking about their success, the success and popularity of the movies as a book adaptation. And I was just wondering, you know, in your expert opinion, is it even possible to make a cinematic or TV or whatever adaptation of Dune? I think this is something that tends to be said about Dune, that it's kind of unadaptable just because of the sort of the complexity, the scale of the novels, how, from what I've heard, how crazy some of the later books get. We seem to have this idea that they just like cannot be adapted to screen. But I think, you know, that could also have been said about The Lord of the Rings as well, in terms of the kind of scale of that universe, its complexity, the challenges of translating that landscape and those peoples to screen in a compelling and understandable way. And yet I think those, you know, the movies were extremely well received, both by sort of casual viewers and by, you know, hardcore fans of the book as well, from what I know. So what do you think of that for Dune? You know, do you think it's even possible? Can you imagine an adaptation that would make you happy as an adaptation of the books themselves? You know, I think it's possible to make a movie, you know, or something inspired by Dune that is a good movie, but maybe isn't a good adaptation of the books. I think those are two different things. And I would say the current movie adaptations maybe lean more in that direction, that you can appreciate them from a cinematic and storytelling standpoint, but that they're not really, certainly from what we've discussed, that they're not really good or faithful adaptations of the books. So do you think that that's possible? Do you think it's possible to adapt the books in a way that is faithful to the original source material? And what would make you happy in an adaptation? What would an adaptation sort of need to have or need to include or need to do in order for you to say, yeah, this is a good adaptation of Herbert's novels and Herbert's vision and messages?
Yes. So this is a question that I've been thinking about a lot, because, and why I wrote my latest book, The Adaptations of Dune, is because I wanted to finally move from just looking at the book into looking at the adaptations, because especially the new ones are so popular, and even the older ones have kind of dedicated fan bases. And I think for me, Dune is too much to encapsulate in film, even giving it two films, because they're, the heart of the book is the political intrigue and the relationships between characters and the character development. And film as a medium has a certain constraint for story arc and what needs to be shown and the amount of dialogue that you can have or you want to have versus what we now expect in terms of action scenes and dramatic events happening. So what I found in looking at Lynch's Dune from the 80s, looking at the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries by John Harrison in 2000, and then looking at Dune Part 1, is that you need to have the time of television, a longer span, to be able to do the book justice in terms of themes and character development. And so to me, through my analysis, I determined that the miniseries is the most faithful adaptation to the story, to the themes, and the characters that I really care about, which is the Bene Gesserit, where you're able to see Jessica as a conflicted mother and in different roles. You're able to see the religious and cultural perspective from the Fremen. Now, they didn't hire Arabic and Middle Eastern people for the miniseries because they were filming in Czech Republic. So the Fremen are mostly Czech and German, but they wrapped around them the elements of Eastern culture and the setting, and even gave them their own special gestures and really made it feel like it was, to me, as much as possible within the constraints they had, a culture that was derived from those. And they used like Bela Kaifa and use Arabic terms and kind of give you the sense that they're a unified culture and a unified religion. That said, I think an even longer series, like giving it a Game of Thrones treatment, would be ideal, which multiple people have commented on. It really needs the length of a Game of Thrones series to be able to delve into all those political intricacies and to show you the different factions and how they're playing games. Like the new film didn't include the banquet scene, which was really important for Herbert. The miniseries is the only one to include the banquet scene. And it's not just a dinner table scene. Like it's all about the different factions and how Jessica and Palmito are learning about the power players. And so I think, and the Lynch film, the first half of the Lynch film is quite faithful, even though it's got a lot of weird, grotesque elements that Lynch liked. It was really because they had to cut the film to fit theaters, or were forced to, that the second half, they did film a lot of scenes that were faithful to the book and then ended up having to reshoot them or cut them. So I'm more empathetic to the Lynch film than I was before studying it. But the new films, I would say, tend to be more inspired by Dune to me than actually trying to recreate those. Especially, I mean, looking beyond the Fremen with the Baron character, and there's a lot of flattening of the characters that happens to focus on the visuals. So visually, it's a stunning production. But to me, where's the story? Where are the characters? You know, where are the factions? Those, to me, are what make up Dune. And then to make these significant changes to the Fremen culture and the uneasiness with religion, you know, what's left of Dune there, it's hard for me to see the rationale for those.
Well, hopefully maybe the third one, if and when there is a third one, will get things on track, but I don't think you're optimistic about that.
It's still a film.
So thank you so much again for coming on to talk to me and for sharing your knowledge of Dune with us.
Thanks for having me. This is great.